Welcome to The Upper Hand, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all aspects of hand surgery, from technical to personal.
Thank you for subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Chuck, we are back with more radial-sided wrist pain.
You know, I know you didn't love the ulnar-sided wrist pain conversations, but what do you think about radial-sided wrist pain?
Better than ulnar-sided and better than tennis elbow.
Fair enough. All our listeners may not agree. And we can work a nerve discussion into this one, I think.
Oh, 100%. I mean the agenda.
We can work a nerve discussion into almost any conversation, can't we?
I think we can. That's why I love it.
All right. I have a request. Can you please share a review with us? Because, I don't know, I like hearing people's commentary.
And you're gonna love this 5-star review from Josh out in Phoenix. So Josh writes, "I'm an academic hand surgeon in Phoenix and love listening to the podcast. I may be one of the few, in Chuck's words, who likes the quote nerve stuff." End quote. What up, Josh? I'd love an episode, Chris, on joint denervation. Yes. Sorry, Chuck. Sorry, Chuck. That sounds great.
Josh, there's hope for you. Keep listening and we'll convince you.
You'd be surprised, probably. I'm not all in on joint denervation, but there are some cases in which it is awesome. So we can definitely talk about that as a future episode. Thank you for the suggestion, Josh. And thank you to everybody who has rated us, reviewed us, and of course, downloads and listens. In reflecting on the podcast experience, giving a Hand Society talk on as part of it, I've really enjoyed the interactions, even with Chuck, but the number of random emails that we'll get, and you know, for me, I get some text messages, and I really have enjoyed it. So it's been a lot of fun so far, and these reviews are keep us going. So thank you to everybody who does that.
That's exactly right. All right, so let's jump in. We had a thorough discussion on dequerveins, and I think we're dequerveined out. But let's consider other sources of pain for the radial side of the wrist. And so how do you think about intersection syndrome, Chris, and what are the pearls you have in making that diagnosis as a first step?
Well, I mean, it goes hand in hand with thinking about dequerveins. To me, intersection is really close by in terms of tenderness of palpation, but it's just a little more proximal than you would typically think a dequerveins would hurt. Little more proximal, slightly more dorsal, but that's how I tend to differentiate it. I bet there's an element of intersection for most dequerveins patients that just kind of goes away once you take care of the dequerveins. I always remember hearing the description of footsteps on freshly fallen snow, which I thought was bullshit because I grew up in Florida and I didn't know what that was like.
But when you, first of all, that's the most eloquent thing I've ever heard you say. And I get the visual and the auditory illusion, if that's the right word. I use the same thing. When you feel and hear that, it's good.
I'm glad my kids will understand that. Maybe I'll have the chance to go step on some snow later on.
Yeah, maybe you will. I'll frame it in my practice. There is one patient population where I see this super rare diagnosis slightly more commonly, and that's the hockey player that gets slashed dorsally in that area and develops this response and inflammation. But this diagnosis is, I don't even make it once a year. What about you?
I'd probably say around that. I mean, I'm thinking about it, but... Yeah. So what's your understanding of what intersection syndrome is?
It occurs where the first compartment sits on top of the second compartment. And I do think it really is probably a proximal iteration of first compartment tenosynovitis. synovitis. But there is a component of inflammation of both the first and second compartments. And I do think it's both. And I think if you're going to end up treating this surgically, which again is super rare, you have to decompress both compartments.
Is there anything different about your treatment algorithm, non-op as well as operative, that is different than dequerveins?
maybe it's because I have less experience and just don't know, but I am more apt to push a splint. And again, I'd use a thumb spica and an anti-inflammatory course for this diagnosis versus de Quervain's.
Yeah, and I would probably be more apt to just try to inject this away.
Perfect. And the injection.
Again, another elegant statement for me this morning.
And this injection works. We know it works. And it's not perfect, but it's. I actually had one patient with bilateral intersection syndrome, but that's the last one I remember in the last couple of years. So it's just rare that they end up going to the operating room because it's rare and injections work.
The hockey player thing is interesting. Is it not just only when they are slashed, but also is there anything about the mechanics of, you know, hitting a puck and holding a stick?
Yeah, it's a great question. I have not found that to be true. There is always a specific trauma relayed to me that is thought to precipitate it. So I don't think it is. But
speaking of trauma to the soft tissues on the radial side of the wrist, what do you make of Wartenberg's syndrome?
Well, first of all, the diligent academician loves Wartenberg syndrome purely as a trivia question, because when I talk about Wartenberg's sign, which is far more important and more relevant to the medical student and resident PIMP sessions, I always follow it up with Wartenberg's syndrome. Again, rare diagnosis, but you have to think about it because it can happen.
Yeah, so we have a listener, Jefferson Lee, who is at UCSF in Fresno, who asked in an email the difference between trivia and minutia. This is a great example of trivia. Whether you know the difference between Wartenberg syndrome and Wartenberg sign is a great example of trivia, stuff that doesn't matter. Now, the minutia of knowing what those conditions are and how, you know, so knowing what superficial radial neuritis is and how to treat it, that is important. That's the good stuff.
Okay, since you challenged me there, I felt the challenge in that statement. I'm going to pimp you, not really pimp, but I know you're going to know the answer to this, which is why I feel comfortable asking it. So the other name for Wartenberg syndrome is choralgia parasthetica. And I always then follow that question with, well, what's muralgia parasthetica?
I wish I knew more French, but it often calls a seatbelt. So that lateral femoral cutaneous neuritis, and I guess it's not a hand surgery, I guess, but I would love to have an episode about that condition because I love treating that condition. You'll probably never let me back on the podcast. We'll have to start another podcast called You Had Some Nerve.
I knew you would know it, which is why I asked it, and I would be a very passive participant in that podcast. And if we get desperate for topics, and that's a hint to the audience, please send us topics. If we get desperate, maybe we will have an episode. Who knows?
We're just going to work our way out, you know, through the different parts of the appendiculoskeleton. So for Wartenberg syndrome, you know, the classic stories are some kind of trauma to that side of the wrist. You know, handcuffs are often, you know, what's in the case vignette. But that nerve is a really pesky nerve. The other way that I've seen it present, and it's not classically Wartenberg syndrome, but is from venipuncture. So, yes. You know, not just a, you know, neuritis, but an actual puncture injury with a needle to either the main part of the superficial radial nerve or one of the dorsal or volar branches.
So there, I'm going to surprise you with this statement. There was a time, Dr. D, when interns had to go start the IV for patients. And that was before you were in training. I know it seems like a different generation, but it was my generation.
Was this for the inpatient carpal tunnel with
the 9-day admit? So in all seriousness, you know, the intern vein was really something I was proud to know where it was. And starting an IV was called upon for interns in all seriousness. And God knows we were never the right people to be starting the IVs, but we were someone the nurse could call for help. And I think you were right. I have seen that trauma to the superficial branch, the radial nerve, from a venipuncture in that location.
So, you know, the treatment algorithm for you, what does it look like?
Oh, and I would say the classic book reference here is a heavy bracelet, a heavy watch, a too tight splint, which I think you alluded to in the last episode. Those are all potential contributors to this problem as well. So removing any offending compression or traumatic device, a period of rest, and anti-inflammatories is where I start. And then I think in my practice, there is a role for an injection. I'd be interested to hear if you agree with that. And then obviously lastly, surgery.
I think if it's one thing that if we're trying to tease this diagnosis out from other diagnoses, if it's, you know, part of a constellation of things, then I think a diagnostic injection is very helpful. If we are feeling pretty good that it is, superficial radial neuritis alone, then I like a single steroid shot in this area. We know the nerves don't love steroid, but, you know, I think that it might wipe things out entirely. And then otherwise, it's something to consider surgery for. I don't know if I'd put a second injection in that area.
Yeah, I agree with that. So do you agree with the algorithm of remove offending agent, splint anti-inflammatories as first step, and then injection, or might you do the injection at the first visit?
I would, if it's crystal clear, I'd consider doing the injection at the first visit. But, you know, I think the brace, I think using the brace and the biggest thing, you know, your point of removing the offending agent, that's huge. But sometimes if it was, you know, a one-time kind of thing and kind of a violent mechanism, that's going to take longer to shake, you know, so, you know, they didn't have a heavy watch on for a long time, but they got cuffed, which, you know, we see that in St. Louis. You know, that's something that can take a while to shake, even with a brace. And, you know, if I think it's reasonable, I'll do the steroid shot then.
Perfect. All right. Surgically, if you fail step one and step two, surgically, classically, as I understand it, I've seen it, you know, I've been there surgically a couple of times, but not often. Either the nerve is penetrating the brachioradialis tendon and it's just too tight, or it's some type of compression between brachioradialis and ECRL. Has that been your experience?
Yeah. And, you know, I think a decompression typically suffices. I talked to Susan McKinnon once in a surgeon's lounge, and we were talking about this, and she started to add some recessing of the brachioradialis. I think, you know, brachioradialis tenotomy might also make some sense in terms of, you know, getting rid of the offending site of compression.
That must have been an incredibly stimulating conversation. You guys must have been searching for conversation fodder.
Well, we will make sure to loop you in on FaceTime the next time we are having that discussion.
Perfect.
And I will go on the record saying that both of us found it incredibly stimulating. Okay.
Of course you did. That's what you
were probably off talking about filling potholes in somebody's elbow by stealing cartilage from somebody's knee.
Oh, the difference we can make. All right. So Wartenberg syndrome is real. It is rare, but it does have to be in our differential.
So then let's go to a diagnosis of exclusion. FCR tendonitis. I hate this diagnosis.
Well, I hate this diagnosis too, but I think I probably see it more than you simply based on my population. So I think you see this in two populations. Number one, I think you see it in the rarely in the athlete who may overtrain with, you know, I don't think you see it regularly with common sports, but if it's an overtraining episode, I think you can see it. And then I think you see it in the patient who may have arthritis or degeneration distally. Those are my two populations where I see it. Again, really rare.
But why is that you see it? I'm thinking of some mechanisms in my head. In that second, in the older population, is it inflammation around the insertion of the FCR at the second metacarpal joint, you know, base of the second metacarpal because of the adjacent thumb CMC joint? Like, what is that?
I don't know, because if you end up, I mean, I think some of those patients will have CMC arthritis. I don't know that that's relevant, but I think there can be tendon degeneration distally, rarely, and somehow or another, the inflammation just invades the sheath is the way I think about it.
So based on your response to what I said earlier, do you think this truly is a diagnosis of exclusion, or do you think that, you know, when you have a patient that comes in with this and you're thinking about that on your differential, are you trying real hard to find other reasons for their pain? Or are you saying, oh, it's FCR tendonitis, that's it?
It is a lower down the list of diagnoses that I would expect to find for sure. But the nice thing is if you do have it in the back of your mind, and perhaps the patient's not been previously diagnosed and they have been seen by others, it's a really straightforward thing to treat. And so, you know, being aware of it and its resisted wrist flexion and point tenderness, and the pain can be right at the wrist crease, but in my experience, it's typically just past that. It's super satisfying if you're able to make this diagnosis.
Well, I think that's where your grayer slash no hair experience comes in. So how do you treat this condition?
I think it's the same thing we've been discussing. A trial of immobilization with anti-inflammatories, a steroid injection, and then lastly, surgical decompression. And again, super rare, but I think surgery can be effective, but it's going all the way out towards that scaphoid tuberosity if it is going to be a surgical intervention.
How proximal do you need to get? So you mentioned going distal, but how proximal do you need to get?
Not very proximally, or you can create a tunnel and, open the tendon sheath, but I don't think it's a proximal issue. So I think if you're within 3 centimeters of the wrist, I typically make an incision at the wrist crease and proximally. And if I can create a subcutaneous tunnel distally, I'll do that and then rarely cross the wrist crease distally. I just hate crossing the wrist crease because I won't do it in a straight line. I'll do it at 45 to, 60 degree angle, but inevitably, that's where the patient complains of post-op.
Yeah. So when I've never treated this surgically, so what do you do in the surgery?
You a lot of these diagnoses where we are treating an inflammatory tendinopathy, allegedly you are removing, synovitis. And I think
like creating more inflammation by surgery.
Yes. There have been cases absolutely where there is impressive tenosynovitis, but there are also cases here and for the ECU tendon where you open the tendon sheath and you're like, well, that tendon looks pretty good. But then if you proceed a little more distally and just decompress it, it seems to work. And again, it's one of those surgeries that is so rare that I don't have an experience that can really form a strong opinion.
One of my most memorable, probably the only memorable FCR tendonitis story I have is the time that I injected somebody's FCR tendonitis and they came back with an FCR rupture. Did not feel good. And I was like, well, I guess, we can't do an LRTI the way we used to do it anymore. But
your pain is probably gone.
His pain was better. So again, another time where I did not feel good leaving the room.
So far more common is obviously a volar wrist ganglion, which is a no-brainer, an occult volar wrist ganglion. And the other thing, which I've been preaching about far more than I should, is an isolated volar scaphoid interosseous ligament injury, which really presents as focal pain just radial to the FCR at the wrist crease. And it could be a ganglion. You can't necessarily tell on palpation. But that's just a pearl to me, that to be aware of that diagnosis.
Yeah, I think you started making us aware of that in our conferences and stuff about a year or two ago. And I'm thankful for that because it's gotten me out of some jams because I've gotten subsequent imaging and it's shown exactly that. And so the feel-good part of it is making the diagnosis. The not-so-good part of it is walking the patient through this whole process where they're, in my experience, and a few patients I've seen with this, they just take forever and a day to get better. I'm hoping you could teach me something new today that would make it go by quicker.
No, I'm not super aggressive with that diagnosis in the sense that I'm not going to rush them to the operating room. I would kind of do the typical stepwise approach that we've discussed with the other diagnoses. I do think if the patient has an isolated volar scapulonate ligament and the membranous and dorsal portions are intact, you are treating pain. So one steroid injection might make sense, but might not be successful.
Just be an intra-articular injection?
An intra-articular injection. I would consider one. I wouldn't do more than one. And then the next step would be surgical intervention. And if you do consider surgery for this, it's when you need that volar radial portal, because you can't see this from dorsally. You might be able to see it from the mid-carpal joint if you really get over the top and go really as volarly as you can. But a mechanical debridement or a heat shrinkage in that area can be effective.
Did you just bring up thermal capsulorraphy, the heat shrinkage? I thought that was forbidden in the sports world nowadays.
It is, but if you're a hand sports guy, it's well accepted.
Oh, man. I can't wait to see what kind of heating pad you can generate for that very small little area.
Oh, for sure. It's miraculous. Miraculous. We're probably killing the mechanoreceptors and the other pain generators in that area, right?
Oh, I was going to say, why don't we wrap up by talking about one thing that that we've each learned about these conditions in the last few years?
Yeah, I think it's just been reinforced to me the importance in Wartenberg syndrome, in all seriousness, It really is about what's on their wrist. And I'm really careful when patients come in and tell me how tightly they're pulling on a wrist widget, for example, that I use for ulnar-sided pain. And they say, if I really make it tight, then it can work. And I say, that's great, but be careful not to make it too tight because it can irritate a nerve. I guess that's my takeaway.
And that can come up with casts too. So making sure that our cast techs and then our residence fellows, and when we ourselves are putting on casts, to make sure that that you have reasonable padding there and there's nothing, no edge or something constricting or compressing. I've learned a lot about the volar SL ligament condition from you, as I just stated, and I think that's been one thing that has been helpful in practice. So thank you for teaching me, Dr. Goldfarb.
As always, thank you for teaching me. All right, it's been fun and a little bit of an obscure topic, but hopefully generates thought and potentially conversation.
Absolutely. Well, I look forward to the next time.
All right, have a good day.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at HandPodcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is @congenitalhand. What about you?
Mine is @ChrisDMD, spelled D-Y. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.